I am delighted to welcome you to the fourth event in our Spring 2014 Leadership Lecture Series. I'm Nicola Pitchford. I'm president of Dominican University of California, and just so gratified that we can provide this community forum. The Leadership Lecture Series is a program of Dominican's Institute for Leadership Studies, which is a leadership development center offering education and training to inspire students and community members and professionals to become better leaders and better team members. And we thank everybody at the Institute for Leadership Studies, led by Dr. Denise Lucy, the executive director. And I'd also like to thank our student leadership ambassadors and our staff volunteers who have made this a welcoming and organized event this evening. The Leadership Lecture Series represents a nearly 20-year partnership with Book Passage, which is, as you know, the San Francisco Bay Area's prized independent bookstore, a community center and learning resource. Our thanks always to Elaine and Bill Petrocelli, and to the entire Book Passage team for their dedication to education and community building. With their partnership, we have been able to present speakers who inspire acts of leadership across the disciplines and the professions. And tonight, Jen Psaki is the 180th world-class author and change leader to captivate our audience through this series. And I'd like to acknowledge our generous sponsors tonight who make this possible. Our silver sponsor is Dominican University's own Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council, a giving circle that inspires women to lead, collaborate, and contribute. Thank you, WLPC, for unwavering support for this series. Our diamond sponsor this fall and spring is Christine Christensen of Engel and Volkers, who will introduce our speaker. For 20 years, Christine has represented Marin's luxury real estate market. She is a founding member of Dominican's Women Leadership and Philanthropy Council, and she's a Dominican graduate, having earned her MBA in international business here. We're very grateful for Christine's community spirit and generosity, both of which are central to our model of education grounded in community. And we're particularly grateful to Christine for her ongoing support of the university and of the Leadership Lecture Series. So I hope you will join me in thanking her and welcoming her to the stage.
Good evening. It's my honor to introduce our speakers this evening. Jen Psaki has built an extremely impressive resume over 20 years in public service. She's worked on three presidential campaigns and served as the State Department spokesperson under former Secretary of State John Kerry. She was White House Communications Director under President Obama, and served as a 34th White House Press Secretary for President Biden through the first 2 years of his administration. She currently hosts the popular MSNBC program Inside with Jen Psaki, and now is a first-time author. Tonight, we celebrate Ms. Psaki's highly anticipated book, Say More, Lessons from Work, the White House, and the World. Say More shares Psaki's journey to the briefing room and beyond, from the campaign trail to the State Department and inside two White House administrations. She addresses the best ways to give and receive feedback, connect with your audience, and listen actively, and use humor to diffuse a tense moment. Candid and clear, Ms. Psaki is known for breaking through verbal noise to successfully deliver a powerful and insightful message to anyone, whether a president, a partner, or even a preschooler. Facilitating tonight's conversation is Lisa K. Solomon, whose signature philosophy is the future doesn't have to be something that happens to us. Lisa is a designer in residence at Stanford University, where she creates experiences like Vote by Design, Presidential Edition, and The Future's Happening to help students learn and practice the skills they don't yet know they need. Lisa was named one of Thinker's 50 thought leaders to watch in 2022, and has created a popular LinkedIn learning courses such as Leading Like a Futurist, and is co-author of the best-selling books Moments of Impact That Accelerate Change and Design a Better Business. We're very pleased Lisa is here tonight to encourage Jen Psaki to say more. Please join me in welcoming Jen Psaki and Lisa K. Solomon.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you for my little earpiece here so you can hear me. Okay. Hi, everyone. It's so great to be here. Thank you for having us.
So you all may have heard I will be playing the part of Mina Kim tonight.
Yeah.
So I will do my best. She is wonderful.
And let me just say, though, can I say, we met this morning on a phone call because we have a mutual friend. We've already talked about democracy. We've hashed it through, how people can have better conversations with each other and engage. She has an amazing book that everybody should also buy. So it's like a new friendship, too. So I'm so grateful you're here.
So grateful. And it's funny that you say that, because when I got the call, they're like, are you available? And I was like, yes. The answer is yes. But the thing, Jen, about you that I got to do a deep dive on today before being here is that you present like everybody's friend. I mean, all of you, right? We watch Jen even, you know, in your various roles, and particularly now, and just a chance to spend some time with you this afternoon, particularly on my ride up and some lovely podcasts. But you have a way about you that is both credible and disarming.
Thank you.
I think the crowd here speaks tonight to what you bring, not only to your work, but to our sense of hope about
thank
what's
you.
Possible. So it's really an honor for me, and I want to, of course, say thank you to Dominican University and Book Passages and just all of the gracious welcome that we've gotten, and it's just thrilled to see a packed house to talk about important ideas like your book. So let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Okay, your book, say more. I just want to say a couple things, because I cannot wait for you to say all the things. This published last week.
Yes.
And is already a New York Times bestseller.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think, again, it speaks to your diversity of your book about how many different kinds of people want to talk about it. Mm. So I know you've been on the road, Colbert, mm-hmm. you were down Pod Save America, among others, and here tonight. So, Jen, I want to actually start with the theme of the book, mm-hmm. which... You might think someone that has had the career that you have had, working in with the presidents that you've had, that you've worked with, that this would be a tell-all, that this would be a book of like the political trail, but it's not that book.
Right.
This is a book about how to communicate and
yes.
how all of us can communicate better. Can you start off by talking about why did you want to write this book?
Sure. Well, I echo everything she said. It's been the warmest, loveliest experience here, and this is a beautiful campus. When I left the White House, I had kind of the first few moments to breathe for a little bit. My kids are 6 and 8 now, so they were that much younger then when I was in the White House. And I thought a lot about, and people were saying to me, friends, family, maybe you should write a book. And I thought a lot about what kind of book would I actually want to write. I'm not really a tell-all cat. That's just not my style. So I thought a lot about the book I wish I would have had when I was in my 20s, when I was, and I hope other people who are not in their 20s certainly read the book, and there's lessons in there for you too, but I wanted to reflect on mistakes I'd made, things I wish I would have known, through the prism certainly of people you all know, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Rahm Emanuel, there's stories about all of them in there, but I thought a lot about that, and also my kids and what advice I would want to give them when they were old enough. And my daughter is only 8 and a half. She's quite precocious. She's read half of the book. There's a story in here, for those who haven't read it, about the Tooth Fairy, which my husband's like, rip the page out. I'm like, I don't know. So, but I wanted them to, I thought about advice I'd want to give her too. And that's really, I wanted it to be something that people could sit with and hopefully take something away from, broader than politics and broader than briefing them from the podium, because most people won't do that. And most people, I hope, won't also be the victim of the Kremlin propaganda machine. I talk about that in there too. But there's applicable lessons, I hope.
Well, it couldn't come at a better time, really. It's a call for all of us to learn how to communicate better, more humanely, with the spirit of empathy and learning. And I want to just even double click on the title, Say More. It's not say more words or
no.
Say louder words. You're
very
deliberate about what you mean when you say more.
That's right. And we actually had this debate with the publisher about the title, because I didn't want to send the message. It was the opposite, actually, that saying more meant talking louder or saying more words. It's actually speaking with impact. And speaking with impact often doesn't mean having the last word or saying more words. It means engagement. It means cracking the door open with people. Maybe that's a reporter, as in my experience. Maybe it's your kids because you want them to eat more broccoli. Maybe it's your neighbor and you think there's nothing you can possibly agree with them on and you can't even look at them when you're getting your garbage picked up. It's quite applicable beyond that, but it's about what successful communications is. It is not having a line that trends on Twitter. It is engagement. That is what successful communications is.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And it's worth saying, it's not make better presentations, convince the other while you're right.
Yes.
You know, win more debates.
Yes.
It is around engagement. And that theme is throughout the whole book. And I love how you weave in stories, very honest stories about your children.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the story of going back to the White House to work for President Biden and how you had a conversation of engagement with your daughter.
Well, I mean, I've briefed presidents and prime ministers. I've even briefed Olivia Rodrigo, which is cool, right? And I think one of the more humbling experiences I had was trying to communicate to my then 5-year-old daughter as to why I was going to go back to work for President Biden. So I lowered the barrier to engagement, which is one of my lessons. Identify your audience, lowered the barrier to engagement. Two of my lessons for audience engagement by taking her to frozen yogurt. I don't know if you all have Sweet Frog out here or something like that, but it's where you go and there's about 15 kinds of frozen yogurt, and kids, especially 5-year-olds, pick the most disgusting combinations, and then they put like sour gummy worms on top of it. It's just, but I took her there, she has her frozen yogurt, and I said to her, so you know that nice man, Joe Biden, who just won the election? I know that's a funny way to describe him, but he's the leader of the free world, but also she was 5. And so she said, yeah. And I said, well, he asked me if I could come back and help him, because he's going to be the president. Again, funny way of describing it. She's 5. And she said, okay. And I said, but that's going to mean that I'm going to have to work more hours. And that's a sacrifice, but it's for the country at this time. And because that's a sacrifice for me, it's also a sacrifice for you, because we'll be away from each other. So I'm thinking in my mind, I'd written this out, of course. I'm a big prepper, which I also talk about in the book. And I was like, I am teaching her about patriotism, and I am crushing parenting right now. That's what I thought to myself. I was like, I am so good. And I said, does that make sense? And she goes, no. And I was like, okay. So the story I tell, because communications is also about emotional connection, and is about how, despite the fact that I thought my patriotic speech would win her over, it actually took probably about 10 or 11 months, because we couldn't take our families to the White House because of COVID, until the turkey pardon. Do you all know about the turkey pardon? The turkeys literally stay in a hotel the night before. That's one detail that I still think is amazing. They're also very large, these turkeys. They're very large. Peanut butter and jelly were their names. I took my kids to the turkey pardon. On that day, they met the president. They got to see where they watch the Today Show. They see when people are doing interviews for the Today Show, where they do it from. And we went to the White House Mess, which is where you can order from a counter. There's a soda machine there. My daughter got to pick a soda. It was very exciting. She picked Sprite. She'd never had it before. It was very exciting. They met the president. On the way out, they gave us cookies, and they said, President Biden wanted you to have this. It was a magical day. We were on the way out, we're in the car, and I said to my daughter, well, what was your favorite part? I mean, what did you like meeting the president? Did you like meeting people you saw on TV? Did you see my office? And she goes, I love Sprite. I've never had it before. I was like, okay. And she said, and the president makes great cookies. And I was like, okay. So that was, but then she loved it. Now, the last part of this story is that actually I did career day at my daughter's school a couple weeks ago. She's now in second grade. And so I was going through and doing things like, who's this? What's this building? And you have kindergartners. And I had actually, the last photo was a picture of Vice President Harris. And I would always say, who's this? And they'd always say, you. And I was like, it's not me. It's Vice President Harris. But they were in kindergarten, so it's okay. But a couple of my daughter's friends said, does the president still make good cookies? And I was like, oh my God, this is the cutest thing.
Oh my gosh.
So that's what stuck with her. But it's about emotion. For a five-year-old, it's about emotion.
Oh my gosh, those cookies, is he still making cookies?
The cookies are good. He does not make them, but you know, I'm breaking out. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, throughout this book, I was reminded of the expression, the communication is the response you get.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, you know, and I love the fact that you were nimble on the fly to be like, okay, cookies, we'll do it. We'll go with that. Sprite. You thought you were having a patriotic moment.
Exactly. Learn the lesson.
And what you talk about very early and throughout the book is the importance of prep and mm-hmm. is the importance of doing your own research mm-hmm. to know your audience, that it's not just about making the best speech mm-hmm. or getting all the material ready, but it's doing it in the context of who it is that you're trying to generate mm-hmm. that response from. And so you talk about the three, you know, core foundations of that, of knowing your audience, crafting the message, and as you said, lowering the barrier mm-hmm. to engagement. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about why that's so important, and even if there were moments where you realized that that was so important.
Sure. I mean, you know, knowing your audience is, if somebody says to you and you're trying to market something or sell something, maybe it's a book, who knows, and somebody says, who's your audience? And the person says, everyone. Everyone is no one. That is not an audience. It's identifying who you need to reach to achieve your objective. That's what communications is actually about. And again, it doesn't have to be briefing from a podium and getting legislation passed. It can be having a conversation with a boss or somebody who works for you. I talk a lot in there about working for different kinds of bosses, which I'm sure all of us have experienced, and how you need stylistic approaches to that. You know, lowering the message and crafting the message is about figuring out the right way to talk about issues so that people can want to crack the door open. And I talk a lot in there, you know, this is a really lovely place. I'm really enjoying it here. I love the West Coast. But in Washington, sometimes people talk, and other parts of the country too, universities sometimes, in a language and a vernacular that does not lower the barrier for engagement. It kind of raises the barrier for engagement. And they do that and use more complicated words and more complex language. I give this example in the book about like Kyrgyzstan, because I worked at the State Department. There are people who are experts on Kyrgyzstan, just like there are people who are experts on everything. But if you talk about it at a PhD dissertation level, you are not lowering the barrier to engagement. You are actually disinviting people from listening to what you have to say. And often people think if they use fancier language or bigger words, that they're going to be listened to. There's plenty of studies, right, that suggest otherwise, and I talk about that in the book too. So I tell this story about when I was early on working for President Biden, who hates vernacular acronyms. It's like he's fine with NASA, but like anything else that's an acronym, you know, he's not for. So early on, I was working for him, and he was practicing his remarks to deliver remarks on, I think it was a COVID relief package. This was quite early on. And I was only about 6 weeks into the job. And he came and sat down with me at a table, and he said, how's it going out there with the press? Like, what are their questions and stuff? And I'm telling him, and he said, well, how are you answering the question? The thing I'm worried about right now is that there's a population of people who don't make enough money to pay taxes, and a lot of these payments are going through the IRS. So how are you explaining to people how they are getting this money or how they should get this money? And I said, and I was a little nervous because I was getting to know him, and I said, well, sir, first I say, if you're a non-filer, and he was like, whoa, nobody talks like that. Nobody knows what a non-filer is. And I was like, yeah, that's true. And so lowering the barrier to engagement, maybe it's frozen yogurt, but it's also speaking in a way that's accessible to people. And I always think about my mother-in-law, who is a retired Catholic school teacher in Cincinnati, Ohio, very smart, very well-read, but does not speak in the vernacular of Washington. Of course she doesn't. She doesn't live there. And if she's like, what's going on with budget reconciliation and the squad? I'm like, oh God, we're like talking about this in a very crazy way. And she's kind of my litmus test for whether we're explaining things in an effective way or not, or was when I was in the White House, yeah.
I love it. Non-filer. Yeah. It reminds me, yesterday I was talking to a colleague of mine, Bob Sutton, who talks about the toxic nature of jargon monoxide.
Yes, this is exactly it. It is, and you meet so many people, what sounds like in academia perhaps too, sometimes.
Sometimes,
and certainly in Washington, where people want to prove
yes.
that they are such an expert on an issue, but then what happens is the audience is like, I don't want to know anything more about that because you're speaking in a language that is not accessible to me.
Yeah, it's such an important part. And again, I love the book because you dispel a lot of these myths that I think we have in our mind. Like you say fancy words to sound smart so that people will listen to you and respect you. And in fact, it's not the opposite, that you don't want to say things that aren't smart, but that, as you said, you really want to communicate in a way that builds trust and builds bonds. Mm-hmm. And I want to say there's such a powerful story in the beginning where you talk about preparing for the first day of being the press secretary for President Biden. And if we could take us back to the Wayback Machine, that was a pretty tense moment.
Yes.
For lots of reasons. And coming out of the pandemic, of course, the what happened on Jan 6. Mm. And you really talk about how you prep to set the tone. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that, about how you thought about that moment.
Yes. So the half step back from that, because I think it's important for the story, is I met with President Biden and Dr. Biden, who was there too, about the job of White House press secretary right before Thanksgiving. And I had not worked on the campaign. I didn't really know him. I actually tried to kind of talk them out of considering me for the job. I was like, I wanted to do the job, but I was like, but he doesn't really know me, and it's so important that you have trust so that you can capture their voice. But I went and met with him about the job, and because I'm a prepper, which I've now acknowledged multiple times, I was like studying South China Sea status and counties in the country because I didn't know what he was going to ask me about. But I sat down with him and. What we mostly talked about is his desire for the person in this job to reset the tone in the briefing room. Because at the time, their nerves were frayed. I mean, people's nerves are still frayed. I'm not suggesting that that has been entirely healed at all, especially given the current environment. But what he wanted to discuss with me was how I thought about that and how I would approach that. And he wanted to take the temperature down in the briefing room, which is a big part of the job of the White House press secretary. I thought about that a lot. Dr. Biden also said to me, I said, how can I serve you best? And she said, we've been through a lot, and I hope you'll always be honest with us, which is an important part of giving feedback. And I tell a story that's quite emotional in the story, but that's also an important in the book, but it's an important part of giving feedback to bosses, too. Anyway. That's relevant because as I was preparing for the briefing, which we did for the first time, as far as I know, on Inauguration Day, which means, by the way, you can't even get into the building until noon on Inauguration Day because it's the former president and his team in the building before that. It was also just a couple of weeks after January 6th, and Washington, D.C. was essentially on lockdown, especially for the inauguration. So we all had to actually go and meet at the National Zoo and park our cars there. I know, I was like, this is like the start of a Veep episode, but here we are.
Right.
And we got on these buses. We all had double masks on. It was the height of COVID. And I had my briefing book. We watched the inauguration on the way there. And when I got to the White House, I went and talked to the president in the Oval Office, and I walked in the Oval Office, and it's still magical. Even though I'd worked there for Barack Obama for on and off for 8 years, it's still a magical place when you walk in, and you feel just kind of the weight of responsibility when you walk in there. And I said to the president, So I think they're going to ask me anything about your day today. Did anything happen? You know, inauguration, you got inaugurated. That's exciting. But also the former president, about the letter the former president wrote you. And he said, did he write me a letter? And I said, well, I don't know. Is there one? So he looked around. He found the letter. It had beautiful penmanship. I mean, I think Trump is extremely dangerous. But what, if he wrote this, it was like beautiful penmanship, which surprised me for some reason. It felt contradictory. So we talked about that and how we would describe it. We also talked about setting the tone. And I knew one of the things that was the thing that would be most important for me in that first briefing was how I answered the question that reporters would inevitably ask, because they always did, which is, how do you see your job, right? Do you work for us? Do you work for the president? Do you commit to never lying? These are the type of questions they ask on the first day. It's sort of a test, but it's also important to set the tone, and I understand why they ask it. And that's what I thought about a lot. I was very stressed the night before, and I tell this story about what I didn't know. There, you're seeing a theme here of my preparation for things. And I was like, what if I don't know about Venezuela? That's what I said to my husband, enough about Venezuela. He was like, they're not going to ask you about Venezuela on the first day. I was like, what if they do? I'm not up to date. So, but that was the most important thing that day, was really setting the tone. And I also talked about how the president, my phone rang a couple of hours after I finished the briefing, and it was unknown number. It's not like, it doesn't say a POTUS on there or anything. And unknown number, and I picked it up, and he said, Jilly and her sisters loved it, as in his wife, Dr. Biden, and her sisters, who's really my audience, which felt incredibly authentic. But it was a remarkable day. I also had so much coffee that day, I didn't sleep that night, but it was a remarkable day, and of course, in my life and experience. So.
Oh, I love that. I love that. How do we know we've done a good job? Jilly and her sisters loved it.
Yes, of course. That's the audience.
Jilly and her sisters loved it. Another theme I want to bring up is something that you talk about in the book, of feeling like you belonged in the room. So this idea of imposter syndrome, of like, wait, do I belong here? Mm-hmm. Should I be here? How do I find my place? And you talk about how you had to kind of grow into that. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could share a little bit about your journey of being like, I belong.
Yes. First of all, this is the part in the book that people who even shock me that they relate to this, even to this day. I mean, Tommy Vietor, who's a longtime friend of mine, one of the hosts of Pod Save America, I co-hosted an episode with him, and we were talking about how we still get nervous when we see Barack Obama, which is really funny. We both worked for him for a long time. But I talk in the book about how when I was first starting out in the White House working for President Obama, that I was so worried about saying the wrong thing or saying something stupid. And he is a uniquely gifted orator, but also brilliant thinker. So it's not an unfounded concern, but you know, but I was so worried about it that it was almost paralyzing. I don't want to be in the meetings, because what if I say something stupid? And I wasn't confident in my own contribution, and the way that manifested itself for me was I just became a super helper, right? I just became the person who wrote the memos and called back all the reporters and just always did the things that nobody else wanted to do, which is actually can serve you well. And I think actually this is advice I often give to people who are recent graduates. It's like, just crush the job you're in. That's like not more complicated than that. But it also means at the stage I was in, I mean, I was the deputy press secretary, deputy communications director, you're not positioning yourself for your voice to be heard, to be seen as a strategist. And it really took me going back, I left the White House. David Plouffe, who had run the first campaign, was back as a senior strategist, called me, and first of all, when I saw his number on my phone, I was like, oh God, I'm in trouble. It's like, how can I be in trouble? I don't work there anymore. I was like, it's fine. I was like, it's okay. But he called me and asked me to travel with the president as a senior advisor, traveling press secretary on the campaign, a job I'd had the first time. And I thought to myself, I want to do this, but how is he going to take me seriously in that way? And I called Robert Gibbs, who'd been the first press secretary for Barack Obama, who had been a mentor of mine. And I said, how do I convince him that I am a person who he should listen to? And he said, act like you belong there, because you do, and at a certain point he'll believe you. Everybody will believe you, and so will you. I mean, which sounds very simplistic, and sometimes people hear it, they think it means fake it till you make it. Not really. I mean, sometimes you have to do that. But I was absolutely qualified for the job. It was convincing myself I could be there and being less fearful. And I also, you know, part of this journey for me, which I talk about a lot in here, is the fear of asking for feedback when I was earlier in my career, as if I would be found out, like I didn't know everything. And of course you don't know everything. I still don't know everything. And I certainly didn't in my 20s and 30s, and I missed out. And for me, the whole transition has been, now I'm like an aggressive feedback seeker. Like, we're gonna leave, and I'm gonna be like, how did it go? What should I say, talk about differently? I harass the team on my show about like what I could have done differently and what can do better. And it's like sometimes 2 a.m. and they're like, please, please, it's too much. But and I understand. But that's been a transition for me, but it took some time. It took some time. And I wish I would have known that earlier.
I appreciate how honest you are in the book about the toll it took on you. And I think it's something that we often feel but we don't say.
Yes.
Which is that when we're avoiding something, it has a cumulative effect of yes. how we show up. And
yes.
so I feel like I want to write Robert Gibbs a thank you note for saying.
I've written him many, yes.
Well, I mean, and you're so generous in the book about mentors and about how you have learned by the part of your research is calling others who had been in this position and learning widely and deeply. I have to ask, I'm sure you've been asked this before, but did you watch West Wing? Did you look at Alice and Janney?
Yeah, okay, first of all, Lawrence O'Donnell, who is just a lovely human and amazing... amazing at what he does. So when I started at MSNBC, I went to see all the anchors because they all have been doing it a long time. I wanted to learn from them. And I sat down in his office and I said, Lawrence, you've been doing this a long time. Like, what can I learn? And he was like, you were just briefing at the podium. Nothing you do here matters. I was like, okay. You know, it was like he was trying to make me less nervous.
Lowering the barrier.
Yeah. But we spent the whole time talking about West Wing episodes because, of course, he was one of the original writers of the West Wing. And now every time there's a rumor it's going to be reboot, I go to him and I'm like, Lawrence, my friends are freaking out. Is the West Wing coming back? And he's like, no, here's why. But
I think that makes us all sad.
I know. I'm like, please. But I had never watched the West Wing before I went and worked for President Obama or on the campaign. Although a number of my friends had watched it, and that's what motivated them to get into politics. When I left the White House in 2011, I was a consultant. I say this in the book. I was a terrible consultant. I'll never be hired to be a consultant again, probably. I acknowledge this in the book. But during that time, I watched the entire series of The West Wing. And I thought, I have to go back. Because, on the best days, it is like that. Right? It is. It is magical. It is stressful. It's high wire act. And so I watched the entire through the Santos election. I mean, I literally mean the whole series in this period of time. And it was a big motivator for me in going back. So I would say West Wing is the best day. Veep is like more likely the description. There's Jonas everywhere. In Washington, we kind of love them, but sometimes we don't. But yes.
Well, I so appreciate that. I mean, that's actually a lot of what I teach and what motivated me to become an accidental civic catalyst was a realization that if we don't see better, we don't know what better can be.
Yes.
And I think that you not only did that in your role as press secretary, but also now in your role at MSNBC and really helping us feel like we can trust what's being said to us. And you're so well prepared, so much research. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what that shift was like for
sure.
you to go from one role to now having a different audience and a different set of objectives.
Yeah, I mean, I had benefited from a couple of things in my transition. One is I had been a contributor at CNN for a couple of years. I had also known and worked with all of these journalists for 20 years because that was part of my job. And when I transitioned to working at MSNBC, one, I was very fortunate because my early conversations with Rashida Jones, who runs MSNBC, and Cesar Conde, who runs NBC, no one asked me to be anything other than who I was. One, that wouldn't be very authentic. If I went out and said, I have no view at all on abortion rights. Like, of course, I do, so I'm gonna share it. And so that was a gift because saying what you think and being authentic about it is actually much less tiring because you're just saying what you think. But what I had to learn a lot of things, and I was very blessed by the fact that there were a number of very generous anchors who gave me all sorts of advice that still sticks with me. I mean, Mika Brzezinski was like, first of all, wear things that are comfortable, which I love that advice. you know, she's like, it can be whatever you want it to be. She's like, I like to wear jeans and blouses and boots because it's comfortable to me, but be comfortable. You don't have to look like you're on, you know, some of those old school movies of broadcast news, or like broadcast news, right? Rachel Maddow sat with me and helped me learn how to read a teleprompter, which is a gift. One, it's a gift from her because she's amazing, but also it's a gift because it's a skill set. You know, I had so many conversations. Chris Hayes, which, you know, I always say there should be a magazine article about everybody's offices because it tells you so much about them. I mean, Chris Hayes, who's this remarkable writer and brilliant, I don't know if he's in Mensa, but he should be. And his office is like stacked copies. I don't know if it's the New Yorker, but it's like all the things. It's what you think it is, his office, which is so lovely. So I was helped so much by the generosity of so many of the people who already worked there. But I had to learn a lot of things, including how to interview people, which is in many ways more challenging than being interviewed because you're in control, you're in charge of making the conversation interesting. And having an hour-long show, it's a huge gift, an opportunity, but you better keep it interesting. Nobody wants to watch a boring show, right, where nothing happens. And one of the things I learned from was told to me by one of my still bosses, this person by the name of Greg Kordick, is nobody at home knows your plan, right? Which is very simple, but what it means is if you're interviewing someone and you expect if you ask them about what do you think about unilaterally bombing Iran, and you expect them to say we should never do that, but we should be concerned, and instead they say we should, and we should have already done it, well, don't go then ask a question about healthcare because that's like a big piece of news, right? That's an extreme example. But listening is actually such an undervalued part of communicating. It's true when you're interviewing, it's true when you're being interviewed, it's true in being present with your family and your kids, and it is an aspect of communicating that people just don't talk about a lot. And that is, I knew how to listen, but listening as you interview people is a different skill set.
It definitely is. And, yes. And again, I think it speaks to prep and your posture of learning, which is so present in yes. this book. And obviously in what you're sharing here, it's like, well, I didn't do it, but I'm going to try and I'm going to practice. And mm-hmm. just before we talked about the importance of deliberate practice, mm-hmm. that we can't be experts at things we've never tried. And the time to try is not usually in a crisis or no. a very high stakes moment. So again and again, you keep saying practice, right? All that work. Nobody came out knowing how to do this.
No, it's so true. I mean, I'm a big believer in a couple of steps. Research, and by research, I mean read a lot. I mean, people are here, they're readers, because this is a book event, right? So everybody here reads. Read a lot, and a lot of things, and read broadly. And, you know, working for President Obama, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, you know, he would read, like, science fiction books, and books about basketball legends, and all sorts of things, because it expanded his mind and his thinking. But read, I mean, to understand issues. And when I was in the White House, one of the things that I felt a responsibility to do was to come to the policy experts. If I went to Jake Sullivan and wanted to get answers on something, I couldn't go to him and be like, now explain to me where Ukraine is. I mean, I had to go informed, with informed questions. The other thing is writing, and this is a piece of advice a lot of people who are now my colleagues gave me. Your own writing is going to be in your own voice, and I find it to be a way to help work out confusion or things that you don't know how to explain. So writing things out, and the third thing is practice. And practicing, it sounds, a lot of people don't do this. And it, actually, if you read things out loud, you can hear when things don't make sense. And so reading things out loud, I'm a huge advocate of, if you're gonna do a presentation or even a meeting, whatever it may be.
I love when you said, when you read it out loud, it all of a sudden sounds very different than the silent words you said in your head when it was awesome.
Right. You're like, oh, that is a beautiful sentence. And then you read it out loud and you're like, that is confusing and my mother-in-law would not understand it, right? Yes. So, exactly.
And it takes discipline and practice. I just want to go back to one of my favorite quotes in the book when you said the importance of listening, because I do think it's like, how many people here took a class on listening, right? Is there anything more important in authentic connection and communication? And you say, being a good listener isn't just about having two ears and a decent attention span. It's about noticing cues that something might be up, responding to shift in tone or topic appropriately, knowing how to ask questions that open a space for discussion. Mm-hmm. so beautiful, again, that you want to do it, that you're actually asking in a spirit of curiosity mm-hmm. and to see where it goes. I want to talk a little bit about the balance of all the prep, mm-hmm. and as you said, then things happened, and the improv. How did you get better at the improv? I know, right?
I talk about comedy in here a bit, because I also think comedy, there are actually, I've become friends with a lot of lawyers, because I don't know if you've noticed, there's a lot of criminal trials going on, so I have to know a lot of lawyers these days. And what some of them have said to me who have argued cases, I mean, before the Supreme Court and really important cases, is that some of them have taken improv classes, because that is actually part of presenting, is being flexible. Prep is not to be rigid. The purpose of prep is to be able to be agile, because you know all of the things. Or and John Kirby, who, if you've watched some of the briefings lately, you've probably seen him, he and I both share this sick love of the briefing, because at that point, you know all of the things. You've done all of the, or you know all the things you're gonna know. You may not know all the things, but you know, you've done all the prep. The purpose of that is to be agile, to be able to listen and engage with people. And that is very true in any type of public presentation, or even in a meeting or an engagement with people. And I find that even for now, for my show, if I have read a lot about a person I'm interviewing, and I've thought a lot about it, and I know what they've said about things, you can just have a conversation, right? Because you don't have to feel like you're rigid following a list of questions. But the prep is for the agility. That's the whole point, to be able to improv in the moment. Although improv makes me, I have ongoing nightmares of waking up having to do a stand-up comedy routine.
You totally could. Yes,
that
yes.
feels very nerve-wracking.
No, but how many yes. people here think she could? Yeah. Totally you could. Yes, yeah. absolutely.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that.
See, look at that. We already have a spin-off of your show covered.
Oh, God.
I do love improv. I love teaching improv because I do think it helps us practice ambiguity. I mean, the thing about improv is that it's different than a monologue, and it's different than a script, and it's different than a play, and you have to practice working with incomplete information at the time and getting comfortable with that, right?
Yeah.
So that, again, when that happens in real life, you can do something with it. So I love that you're learning from comedians.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have a lot to teach us. Okay, so speaking of comedy, before we get into some of the fabulous questions that you all have asked, I love the chapters, the names of the chapters. Oh. It is not like chapter one, chapter two. It is like, what if they ask me about Venezuela? Mm-hmm. Like the first chapter is, remember when that nice man won the election?
Mm-hmm. What? You know the story, part of the story.
Yes,
there's more in the chapter.
Right,
yes.
And what the heck is a non-filer? Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you first about one of them in particular, and then I want to ask a little bit more about the chapters. When to serve a sake bomb.
Oh, well, this chapter, as I start this chapter, I basically say, this chapter is not really about Peter Doocy, but everybody has a Peter Doocy in their lives, or some version. And that a couple of the most common questions I get asked, we'll see what the questions are like, what's Joe Biden really like? Another one of them is, how much do you hate Peter Doocy? And the truth is, I don't hate him at all. We actually had a great relationship. I think he would say the same thing, I think, who knows. But but I talk in this chapter about dealing with combative engagements. And while my Peter Doocy relationship, while we had combative conversations in the briefing room, one actually was quite predictable, because in the White House press secretary's office, you have kind of four screens of television, and you can watch what is being covered by each cable network, and therefore it's pretty predictable what they may ask about on any given day. Right. And if it's like a circle of ongoing crime, 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 then you're going to be asked about crime in the briefing room. So there's a predictability of it. But Peter and I, as much as we had kind of a back and forth quite a bit. He would come to see me in my office. We would talk off the record. We'd talk on the record. He conducted himself in actually quite a professional way. There are some aspects of how those exchanges went down and how they were digested that's probably not saying positive things about the division in our country right now, in the sense that we'd have an exchange and half of Twitter would say, he destroyed her, and she's a liar, whatever they said, some version of that. And another half would say, she got him, she took him out, right? I did a lot, but still, you know, that aside, but that's not always, that also tells you a lot about how people consume things. But we did take a picture. There's a lot of pictures in this book too, and we took a picture on my last day there. And even though I'm wearing very high shoes right now, they're comfortable because they're wedges, as all the ladies know. I was wearing flats, and he is like 6'5" or something, and I am 5'3". And so we took this picture, and we both posted it on Twitter, and there was like these crazy conspiracy theories, like maybe he was a giant, maybe I was 4'4", and nobody knew. It was very funny. But yes, there is, but in the same chapter, and I won't go into more detail, I want to take all of your, as many questions, I do talk in a more serious note about what I learned about being a target of Russian propaganda, which I was long before what we're seeing right now happen. And this was in 2014, 2015, when most people, unless they were covering Russia or from Eastern Europe, didn't really know about the propaganda machine and the work of the Kremlin. And because I was the State Department spokesperson at the time when they invaded Ukraine back in 2014, 15, I became one of the faces of calling out the United States opposition to their invasion. And as a result, what they decided to do is discredit me, or attempt to. It was extremely gendered, sexist. There was a show at night on RT where they talked about me nearly every night. There was a term that government officials used, sockying, which they was confusing things. I didn't confuse things. They made up things I never said. It was a whole journey in learning. And if you're wondering how it feels to be the victim of Russian propaganda, not good. It does not feel good. But I learned a lot in the time about how you fight back at bullies. And you have to call out what their objective is and why they're attacking you. And everybody hopefully will not experience exactly that. But what I learned is what I started to do is call out, well, they're attacking me because I'm accurately saying that they illegally invaded Ukraine. That's a fact. I'm not confused about that fact. And I would simply call out their motivation, which I think there's forum for nowadays. And I think that that experience I had can be quite applicable as people face, unfortunately, a range of rising threats and things along those lines.
I mean, there's so much to learn from that. First of all, staying calm even when you are getting attacked, and then the ability to parse out the clarity from all the noise and just to be able to neutralize it with just an observation based in fact. So I think a lot for us to learn from. Oh my gosh, there's so much to learn about, including, you know, working with Rahm Emanuel and John Kerry,
very different folks.
But I promised we're going to get to questions here. Okay, first of all, your questions are amazing. They are wonderful. I want to start with a very thoughtful comment, which is, I watched you on your first day. You stepped into the podium. I knew that you were going to change the trajectory of the briefing room.
Oh, thank
Keep you. Up the great work. You are an amazing communicator. Smiley face.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So sweet.
Thank you to whomever wrote that. Thank you very much.
I like the smiley face. Know your audience.
Like a smiley face. We love it.
Okay, here's another thank you and a question. We're getting into the moment of the day here, which is, I think, right. Thank you, Jen Psaki. As you articulate news of the day in these complex times with clarity and calm, what is your wish for grassroots workers in the 172 days across the nation?
Wow, what a good question. Well, I'm going to, because we were talking about this before we came out here, and I think you articulated this better than I could have, but I think that there's a feeling sometimes that people feel overwhelmed by the scope of what we're facing. And as a result, you can feel powerless and hopeless. The key and antidote to feeling powerless is to do something, and it can be a small thing, and a small thing is a big thing. And that's the thing to remember. And so what you may feel like is a small thing, like once a month I'm going to go door knock, or once a month I'm going to go make phone calls, or I'm going to put up a yard sign, whatever it may be. Yard signs don't win elections, but still have one in your yard, that's still good. It is taking a small step can make a contribution. I'll also tell you that every moment you feel powerless, you are the most credible sources in your communities and to your neighbors. It's not me, It's not even Lawrence O'Donnell, who we all love because he got great cheers in there, or Rachel. It's all of you to your neighbors. There's tons of data about this. It does not mean, I'm not suggesting, go argue with your neighbor who has like a MAGA flag. They're probably not reachable. That's okay. We don't need every person. But you should empower yourself to do small things. That is what I would say is the antidote to feeling powerless and feeling like in this moment, it's overwhelming. I will tell you, I mean, in my trips, not today, although if it's okay, I will give you a hug if you want one, but people will come up to me and say, is it gonna be okay? And sometimes people, and it's like, I don't know, you know? It's gonna be determined by what happens and what people do, but small things are big things. I don't talk about this in the book, but you may remember, and this is one of my favorite things, and I went to almost every event that Barack Obama did as when he was running for president both times, where he would tell the story. Do you remember the story of the little hill lady in the hat in Greenville, South Carolina? How she is the one who got him to do Fired Up and Ready to Go, which became a big chant for him. And he told the story because it was a reminder that one person in one room can change the trajectory of the room, and one room can change a county, can change a state. And that's an important thing to remember when you feel overwhelmed, disempowered, stressed, scared, fearful. A little scared, a little fear is good. Everybody needs to be a little fearful. But that's what I would say. But yeah. You've thought about this so much. Do you have anything to add, or what do you think?
Yeah, I agree completely that I think one of the most important things is to feel like you have agency over something.
Yes.
And that there's so much that we have that we can do. As you said, small things are big things. A couple weeks ago, I hosted something at Stanford called the Future's Happening Democracy Edition, because the future is happening.
Yes.
So we had a happening about the future, and it was all focused on sharing bright spots of today in order to shape a better tomorrow. Mm. And we had 30 posters ranging from literally Sesame Street, and I actually got Elmo to give a video to remind us that we're one big neighborhood, just to reframe, and to remind us that we have a lot more in common and a lot more to celebrate. And people would say, well, what is it that you want out of this? And I said, well, I want 3-2-1 was what I said. I want them to know 3 stories that they didn't know before of good things happening. I want them to walk out with at least 2 people that they're excited to follow up with, because we need to find connection to each other. And 1 idea, even if it's small, that they're excited
to do.
That's
very actionable. I'm so glad I asked you that.
Thank you for asking.
Do that.
Thank you for asking. And I just want to say one more thing about that I've been also working with a lot of student athletes to help them use their popularity and power on campus. And when people say, you know, is there hope? Did you like Ted Lasso? There is hope, right? That is a civic show.
Oh, that show is the greatest. Yeah. I will say, are you all Ted Lasso fans? People watch the show? I need to watch it. One of the things I used to do before the briefing, sometimes if it was going to be a particularly prickly day, and you knew when it was going to be a prickly day because you didn't have enough information to share with the press, you knew. I would do, in the first season, Rebecca, who's the greatest character, would do this thing where she would make herself like a tree, right? Before she would go into these meetings with all of the men who ran the other soccer clubs. And I would do that sometimes before the briefing, which became part of my ritual.
The power pose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. This is a wonderful question just about who you are, and clearly people are curious.
Thank you.
They said, what is your favorite memory that impacted your life's journey in a positive way?
Oh my God.
We care out here, Jen. You got to spend more time out here.
That impacted my life in a positive way. Gosh, there are many. I'm going to take a serious answer to this one. I love my children and my husband and all of them. They're amazing, of course, but I'm not going to answer it in that way. We can talk about them as much as you want. You know, one of the things that I did change my trajectory professionally, which has been a big part of my life that's been so fulfilling, is when my friend Ben Rhodes called me and said, you should go to the State Department. You'd love it and you'd be great. And I said, I don't know a lot about foreign policy. And a lot of people said to me, including people I respected and bosses who'd give me great advice, including Robert Gibbs, don't do that. If you make a mistake, you'll ruin your career, right? But I decided, YOLO, you only live once, but also that risk was worth taking. And I've never regret a risk. And I have messed up and made mistakes plenty of times. I talk about a lot of them in the book. But having a very small degree of risk aversion, and that particular moment when I decided to do that was a big, because in part, yes, professionally, but also I got to travel the world, which expanded my whole perspective and my brain and my mind and made me feel like the world is a much smaller place. And that does change your perspective. And now I talk to my kids. My daughter will say to me, okay, she's very precocious, as I've already said. She'll say, Mom, I want to do a trip together. I just took her to New York. She walked out of the train station. And she said, I love it here. Oh, that's who she is.
I love it.
That's who she is. But she said, because I talk about traveling internationally a lot, and she'll say, I want to do something together. I'm like, great, like maybe go see a movie, whatever. And she'll be like, I was thinking you and I could go to Paris. I was like, Paris? Like, who are you? You're 8. So, but, you know, I think that expanded my whole life perspective, and so that was a big changer for me.
I love that. I love that. Again, the learning spirit, very present. And again, for the students in the room, I love how you talked about right after you graduated college, you were in a job that was just not lighting you up.
No.
And yet you remembered that you had a volunteer experience that got you excited. So I also worked on a campaign, my first job. So we'll you should talk about that
yes.
too.
Yes. Campaigns, we love them.
We love campaigns. You learn a lot. Okay, I just want to say, like, half these questions are like, are you running? Will you run?
Oh my
Jen
God.
Psaki for president. When is that happening?
Okay.
But
never.
I think, yeah, no, okay, all right. Not yet. Could we say not yet? Learning
no.
mentality. Okay. But here's one close, which I like. If you were asked to interview Biden and Trump's debate, would you do it? What questions might you ask? And I'll add a third, since we've talked about it so much tonight, how would you prep?
Wow, so many good questions. Well, that would be very fun. However, I worked for one of the candidates, so I think there's no scenario where that would ever happen. One day, would I love to moderate a presidential debate? Yes, I would love to do that one day, or other debates. I think that would be fantastic. How would I prep? I would read and consume as much information about both of them and everything they've said about the major issues of the day as possible. I know a lot of them because I talk about them every day. But what I always think is interesting is when you can find things that people don't talk about every day. And, you know, I interviewed Governor Sununu, this was over a year ago, and we talked about Trump and talked about his views on Trump, which at that time were quite negative, though he's going to vote for him. But that aside, I just asked him about his views on gun safety and gun violence. And it turns out he was like supportive of a position in New Hampshire where people could have guns in their cars at schools. It's like, what? So, you know, I use that as an example because I think sometimes it's right now, and this is a thing I think the media, everybody in the media struggles with, because the trials are a huge part of what's happening in our country. This has never happened before. It is a moment in history. It's important to inform the public as much as we can about what is happening, and there's no cameras in the courtroom. It consumes a lot of the oxygen. There's a lot of other issues at play, and important ones. So I would talk about that, but I also would study and spend a lot of time consuming a lot of other issues, because there are some differences and some things that deeply impact people that I don't think always get as much attention as they should.
Yeah, I love that. Again, you could see, like, knowing your audience, right, of trying to inform the voting public about the choice that they have. I'm gonna paraphrase a question here kind of related to that, and the question is essentially, when you made the switch from being press secretary to then now being on cable news, do you feel like you're serving the country in a different way? So I wonder if you could talk a little bit.
You know, I get asked this question a lot too now. It's like, it must have been so dramatic, it must be so different. And, you know, I think the media there's a wide world of the media, which is important for everybody to understand. And I'm a believer that most people in the media are good apples, meaning they are doing a public service themselves. There are some bad apples, of course, but most are good apples. And what I learned is, even though there are different objectives, of course, it's the role of the media as a part of democracy to push for more information because you're serving the public. but also the type of people who work in media are similar to the type of people who work in government, which is nerdy in the best way possible. Curious, endlessly curious, always wanting to know more, having more information. And one of the coolest things that I loved about working in government is you could be on your way to the ladies' room and kind of run into the person who is like running NASA and ask them about what's happening there. I mean, you know, that's a kind of a random example, but truthfully, those type of things happen. And now, Tom Costello, if you watch NBC, you've seen him do a range of news reporting. He is around the corner from me, and it's like, hey, I saw that thing you did on National Airport. I didn't know that. There's an endless curiosity and interest, and that is serving the public good, and it is different than working in government. I'm a huge believer in public servants, and even though institutions are being attacked and very unpopular, in my experience, some of the most wonderful and amazing people work in institutions and in government and in foreign service and civil service. But there's a similarity in that way. But it was a transition in part because I'm a believer you have to kind of not just say what you're gonna do, but do it, just do it, and then prove yourself in that way. And I knew that there would be skeptics, probably still are, I don't know, maybe they're not telling me, about how I would transition, how that would be. Would I be able to be critical when warranted? Would I be able to bring unique insights? That's incumbent upon me, but you know, you have to prove by doing.
Yeah. Well, here's another card that suggests that you're proving by doing, and it says, just would like to say thank you for all that you have done. And I think many of us feel that way. And we're just about time, but I want to read something from the very last chapter in your book when you talk about some tough things with your children, mm-hmm. like war. You know, you have young children and how you talk about that. And again, what's so wonderful about your book is that you clearly make it universal, right? That this isn't just if you happen. Anyone here going to be press secretary? And you know, but that
maybe.
this is you know, and this is a set of skills that we all need in this moment. And we're talking about what could we do in this moment. Well, first of all, read the book, and practice them, right? Practice engaging, not monologuing. Engaging. And so you reflect on listening to how you described something, you know, about war to your daughter, and then you overheard her talking about it with your younger son. And you say, great communication skills are more like building blocks than steps on a checklist. You can't craft a message if you don't know your audience. You can't know your audience if you don't research. You can't deliver the message if you haven't developed trust and credibility as a speaker. You can't build credibility if you don't accept feedback graciously. Correct yourself when you make a mistake or set realistic boundaries. It all takes an enormous amount of work. Thank you for putting in an enormous amount of work so we could see what good looks like. Jen Psaki, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You were so great. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you.